Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We get out of the studio and onto the road to find the kind of radio you don't hear so much anymore. Stories off the beaten path and usually away from the top headlines. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the show. Our email address, indianaweekend@gmail.com. I'm John Strauss. Thanks for tuning in today. One of Indiana's most famous mysteries turns 100 years old in a few weeks. It's the story of Catherine Winters, a 9-year-old girl who just vanished one day in Newcastle. The story is well known there and was a national sensation as a mystery when it happened on March 20th, 1913. There was a huge amount of coverage in the New York Times, Los Angeles, Chicago, and other papers because no one could believe that a girl heading out to sell packets of sewing needles could just disappear. Many folks around Newcastle know the story. Now it's getting a fresh look in a book by a former Muncie Star Press reporter and current Ball State journalism instructor. Colleen Steffen became almost obsessed with the disappearance. And when you listen to her talk about it, you can see why.
Her mother had died when she was 5 of tuberculosis. Her father was a dentist and probably a drunk. Her stepmother may or may not have been evil. She had a one-armed telegraph operator who boarded in her home. She had a little brother named Frankie.
That's an interesting detail, the one-armed telegraph operator.
Like, you can't write that stuff, right?
You're a feature writer. This had to be one of the most interesting assignments you've ever had.
Oh, yeah. And I was a feature writer when I found it. I was at the Star Press, and I was on a totally unrelated mission in the digital archive looking for articles. And I just happened across an older anniversary story. And it immediately, like, intrigued me. It's got so many weird details and coincidences and twists and turns. And I made a copy of it because I've always wanted to write a book since, like, second grade. And this just struck me as, like, a potential project. So flash forward, I don't know how many years, 5 years, 8 years. And I had the time, and it's the first thing I started looking up in the library. And the first thing I wanted to know was there enough to make a book? Were there enough details? And it was astounding, just that mountain of articles that she generated. And because the case dragged on a year and a half solid, and it was almost daily news coverage and scads of newspapers. So there was plenty. And the more you found out, the more you wanted to find out. So my obsession was born.
So you had a nine-year-old little girl who leaves home one morning to sell packets of sewing needles
door
for
to
a
door.
Charity.
Yeah, one story said it was for a church missionary society, and another story said it was for pocket money. And I've always wondered what was true, because they embellished her tale almost immediately. They polished her up, you know, in the press. So anyway, for one reason or another, she leaves home after breakfast. She was wearing a red sweater and a straw hat with blue forget-me-nots. And that was another one of those picturesque details. Like, what a perfect thing to wear on your hat when you disappear, blue forget-me-nots. So she is seen all over town for hours. She is seen walking up and down Broad Street where all the businesses are. She plays at a friend's house who has a dollhouse. She greets family friend Dan Monroe around noon. She's seen watching a group of gypsies water their horses, because this part of Indiana was on a regular migration route of gypsies at the time. And so she's spotted here and there and everywhere by people she knows, and then she vanishes.
And she becomes part of the lore. This is, sounds like the kind of story that parents would tell their little kids to scare them. And
Yes, immediately, almost immediately. It touches off a lot of fear with parents in Newcastle. And this is a really interesting time in Newcastle history. This is the county seat, but it's a small town that just in the last 10 or 15 years has exploded. Its population has doubled. It's built 4 elementary schools in 4 years, 4 or 5 years. It's a hotbed of industry. It's got one of the first state automotive factories. It's got a
That's
piano
right. That was
factory.
The time when Indiana was really the center of the car business.
Yeah, I mean, we would die for this kind of, like, economic growth that Newcastle was experiencing in this period. It had Hoosier Cabinet Factory. It was the leading exporter of American Beauty roses. It had a huge horticulture industry.
In Newcastle.
In Newcastle. And people were flooding into Newcastle for jobs. They had a housing shortage. They had a tent city in city parks housing workers for some of these factories. They couldn't build houses fast enough. So you have this formerly sleepy place that is like sleepy places are. And also add on, it's 100 years ago, you know, a little complacent about, well, sure, kids can go door to door and not be chaperoned. And we know most people who walk through our town. But all of a sudden, we've got interurban lines passing through, new rail lines. You can be in Chicago in 3 hours. You can be in Cincinnati. You can be in Indianapolis. So I believe that precipitated what happened to Catherine.
What do you think happened to her?
I disagree with most people. The consensus is, the general consensus has always been that her parents did it. Her stepmother and the one-armed boarder were having an affair. Catherine discovered it, and they did away with her somehow, and that the father found out later and helped them cover up. And they were supposed to go on trial for that in June 1914. The prosecutor dropped the charges the morning of the trial. He said he didn't have enough evidence to win it. But they were definitely damned in public opinion. But I don't think they did it. I think they didn't look good. I think they had weird family history that looked pretty bad. And I don't think they helped themselves in the press. I don't think they had the personalities to handle it. But I think it was a stranger. I think
What makes you think that? I mean, that sounds like with all these lines, rail lines going through and
yep.
all kinds of people there. I could believe that.
I think the opportunity was definitely there. And also, it's a time in history where those, you know, child predators exist, but they're not on the radar of law enforcement. And law enforcement in Newcastle is basically a handful of men who may or may not be very well trained. They don't have their own automobiles. There's not a very specific protocol you go through to become a policeman all the time. It's not on their radar. It's not something they immediately would think of or check for. And then, you know, I read 2 years worth of coverage in 4 different newspapers. So I read from February 1914 to like August, September, well, like February 1913 to August, September 1914, every single page of 4 different newspapers. So two dailies, one weekly in Newcastle and one daily in Indianapolis. And I found 2 articles that reference strangers assaulting little girls on the street of Newcastle. One's 2 weeks before, one's a month after Catherine disappears. The girls are within a year of her age. And I think nowadays that'd be pretty clearly something you would follow up on and take really seriously. But at the time, they were kind of just anecdotes that were passed and let go.
Colleen Steffen, a Ball State journalism instructor and former reporter with the Muncie Star Press, talking about her book on the Catherine Winters mystery, the disappearance of a 9-year-old girl that stunned Newcastle and triggered national interest. Somebody called it something like Indiana's version of the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Indiana Weekend, real radio from just down the road. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line to let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
One of Indiana's most famous mysteries is getting a fresh look from a reporter determined to understand what could have happened on a spring day 100 years ago when a 9-year-old girl walked out of her house and into history. The story of Catherine Winters shocked Newcastle and intrigued the entire country as national coverage focused on the girl's disappearance. The puzzle grew murkier as more details emerged. The one-armed man living at the family's house, speculation about her stepmother, a father who drank too much, suspicion about gypsies who traveled through the area. Catherine Winters had simply stepped out to sell sewing needles for a charity. When she disappeared, a mystery was made, and a legend was born, which is where Colleen Steffen comes in, a former Muncie Star Press reporter now teaching journalism at Ball State University. She tugged at the loose threads of the story after coming across a reference to Catherine Winters in some old clippings. Then, nearly a century after Catherine's disappearance, it was as if her story had come alive once more.
I started with the Indianapolis News. William Blodgett was a famous investigative reporter that worked at the news in this time. I believe he's one of the first people inducted into the Indiana Journalism Hall of Fame. He was married to a girl from Newcastle, Minnie, And so he had a lot of family and connections and understood how that town worked. And he took a special interest in it, and he did the best coverage. It's very colorful, and it's for an out-of-town audience. So it's got a lot of detail that the Newcastle papers are assuming their audience already knows. And he did wonderful coverage. But anyway, I started with him. So I started at the Ball State Library in the microfilm, and that dark corner getting carpal tunnel from the microfilm machine. And then I started going to Newcastle. Everything's a microfilm. Someone needs to invent a way to digitize historic newspapers. That would be a gazillion dollar idea. But, and also, you know, back in that time, the newspapers are so big, and the paper that they're printed on is large, and the print is so small, so you can't even get the whole page on the microfilm machine to read it. So it was scanning. I don't know what made me keep going. One time I went to the library 3 times a week for 8 hours a time for 5 weeks without finding anything I needed. But I just kept going. I think that's officially the definition of an obsession.
Good for you. What an amazing effort. But, you know, if you hadn't done that for 5 weeks, you wouldn't have found the stuff that you later found, right?
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you have to hit a lot of dry holes to get to the ones that are productive, right?
Yeah, and there's something exciting about knowing that, yes, all this stuff's public record and it's readily available if you go to look for it, but no one has seen it for 100 years because who has the time or energy or desire to do that? And so it felt like discovering something that had been totally forgotten. And Catherine has been forgotten, which is really interesting. She was national news. She was covered in the New York Times. She was covered in the LA Times. She was the subject of one of the very early news films that showed in theaters across the nation. She was an obsession of the Chicago newspapers, Cincinnati, Columbus. She was a household word, like a JonBenet Ramsey, I would argue, or a Kaylee Anthony. And she has been almost completely forgotten except in the Newcastle area.
In her day, a national story about a disappeared girl, age 9, who walks out to go around selling packets of sewing needles and just disappears. Does she have relatives now? Were you able to talk with anybody from the family in current times?
Her brother died young, without kids. She doesn't have direct relatives. Her dad didn't have any other children. She has some, I guess, children of aunts and uncles, but elderly, you know, not really invested. Yeah, I think the people that remembered her stepmother had some surviving relatives that took a really big interest in the story because their aunt had been so maligned in the press. She was definitely set up as the evil stepmother out of a fairy tale. They took a lot of exception to that, I think for good reason. But no, not a lot of people left.
Is the story still remembered at all in Newcastle as you walked around and talked with people?
Oh, yeah. She's really well known in Newcastle. Like on the ghost story level, she's been trotted out in some local, you know, history, ghost lore books. The Courier Times will visit her story at Halloween. And on the anniversary, she's usually remembered on March 20th. In the 90s, an Indianapolis TV station came and I guess around 2000, the Historical Society and the Funeral Association and some other groups finally erected a memorial for her in the cemetery there. So she definitely has some people there who continue to remember her, and definitely a cadre of armchair detectives who have made a hobby of researching it, looking into it, who I've made friends with. Infiltrated.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Sounds like something there could be regular meetings or a get together on the anniversary or something like that.
Yeah, it's her story is staying power with those people.
I think every town has some sort of story like that, don't you? I mean, there are collections of Indiana ghost stories or ghost stories from other places. And
yeah, I totally agree. And at first, when I first started investigating her, I really thought that's all she was an interesting, macabre sort of sad, unsolved mystery of that kind that just people kind of naturally like and are interested in. But as I investigated, I found that she really had something special to say about her town, what it was like then, and that town was very indicative of towns at the time. It says a lot about state, regional history. She really was a bellwether for a change in society, I feel like.
How so?
Well, 1913 was a very interesting time. It's the progressive era. There's a sense of optimism. There's a sense that we're going places, that Newcastle's a burgeoning city, that it's improving itself through industry and finance. And that things are on the up and up, and it's this pause in history before the influenza outbreak, before World War One, before World War Two,
right.
The Depression, and we forget. I personally, and I'm a fan of history. I'm not an academic historian, but I'm a lover of history, and I never paid attention much to this little era because it's right before all of these major crises in our nation, and so I had no idea that we were changing. How we raise our children, how we live in our houses, how we dress, what we do for jobs, what we think is important. It was a huge change in our society and optimistic. People really thought that things were changing for the better. And Newcastle definitely did. It was a town of boosters and fans. They had a collection of men who had a lot of foresight and activism, and they developed one of the early, basically an industrial club, I think that's what they called themselves, where they set out very specifically to woo industry to Newcastle. It was a couple guys who were from there who had made successes out of their lives and wanted to bring more of that home. And so it was an organized effort to attract industry, to attract business, and they were really successful.
Colleen Steffen, former Muncie Star press reporter, now teaching at Ball State, on Newcastle just after the turn of the century in 1913, the setting for one of the state's best-known mysteries. Catherine Winters simply disappeared, shocking the city, triggering a national sensation as newspapers from New York to Los Angeles wrote about the case. Steffen is author of a book on the disappearance, just a few weeks ahead of the 100-year anniversary of Catherine's disappearance on March 20th.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
Now, turn it up just a little. Give me a little more.
All right. You're listening to Indiana Weekend. Is that right? Can we get it typed up? I can't remember it. Okay. This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
We're telling the story of Catherine Winters, or I should say, writer Colleen Steffen has just written a book on the mystery of the girl's disappearance in Newcastle 100 years ago next month. Newcastle was a different place then, a bustling hub of industry, bursting with economic growth and development. So many people moving in that folks created tent cities in the parks to house all the newcomers. There was immense civic pride in Newcastle, and that showed as the entire city turned out to find Catherine Winters.
They have a very can-do attitude about it, like, she's gone, we'll find her. What do we have to do? Within a week or two, they have a town-wide work stoppage where all the men are released from the factories. Close to 1,000 people do a systematic search of Newcastle. We're talking inside people's homes and in their cisterns. They check outbuildings, brush piles. Women and children spend the whole day looking. They have, within days of her disappearance, and of course the search is impeded somewhat because the day she disappears is a history-making storm that devastates the Midwest. So they're put off a couple days. But they organize a committee, they fundraise, they have assigned leadership roles. They have that attitude like, there's no problem that we cannot fix with some organization and some leadership and some money. And so when the search drags on and nothing works, people start backbiting each other, doubting each other. It betrays this crack in what they think is a beautiful foundation for their town. It's really interesting.
So what did people think happened to her?
Her father thought gypsies stole her, which to me is pretty clear xenophobia of the time.
Because there were gypsies around. There were all kinds of people around.
That was I was interested to find that out, that they were a regular facet of middle Indiana life. They were on a regular circuit. They would come through in painted wagons and their ethnic clothing, and they fascinated the people who lived in these small towns they passed through, but they were also treated with a lot of mistrust and, I would say, abuse. Mm. And they happened to pass through Newcastle on the day she disappears. And she's cited by several people watching them water their horses because they would attract crowds sometimes. And so, of course, people blamed the gypsies, and the gypsies were persecuted for years and years in Indiana. I read in a couple accounts that people felt like they largely abandoned Indiana for that reason. I'm talking dozens and dozens of camps searched at night, people dragged into police stations, I'm sure beaten up. So it was a really big problem.
What were some of the other theories about the disappearance?
Well, the stepmother and the one-armed border, that was the sexiest, which I think is why it stuck. People thought perhaps that she'd wandered out of town, been washed away in the flood. March 20th was the first storm of a system of storms that hit the Midwest, and it was devastating from like Ohio to Michigan, through into Illinois, like downtown Dayton caught on fire and burned down, massive flooding, you know, hundreds of people dying. And Henry County was affected. There were tornadoes all over the place. So people conjectured perhaps she'd gotten out into the countryside and been caught up in some of the flooding.
People must ask all the time, has her body ever been found or
never found.
Searched for?
They found three pieces of physical evidence a year after she disappeared, more than a year. They found it in her parents' basement. It was a red sweater and a man's blood-stained undershirt and a hair ribbon.
Wow.
So pretty damning physical evidence.
Yeah, yeah.
But collected by a detective that was hired by nobody knows who and a collection of police and newspaper reporters. A lot of disputes about how authentic it was, whether or not it was what it purported to be. And it wasn't conclusive. Many people see that as conclusive, but, you know, the prosecutor wouldn't press forward with charges. So
even then, the chain of evidence demands were a little more strict than that.
Yeah.
I can imagine for a person like you, a skilled reporter and feature writer, on one level, this would be really fun. But on another level, this is an enormous undertaking. Are you glad to finally put a period at the end of this book? Or
oh, you know, I could keep going. I could. I learned that about research, that I don't think you're ever done. I think you just have to declare it over. And I definitely could keep going. It just, it's such a collection of interesting people and times, and I could.
Maybe there's another Indiana story out there for you.
Oh, I hope so.
You know?
Yeah, I hope there's something else.
Colleen Stephan, writer of the book of the story of Catherine Winters. What's the title and where do we find it?
It does not have a title yet, and it's being marketed right now by the Sarah Kimmelly Literary Agency.
So is there a website that you go to or pre-orders or whatever?
Yes, please go to the website. It's whereiscatherinewinters.com. I'm also on Facebook under the same name. And I'm on Twitter. It's at whereiscw.
Nowadays, all the rage is self-publishing. You get to keep all of the proceeds yourself. Have you thought about that?
You know what? I got an agent and I was so thrilled about that. So I'm just letting her do her work for a while.
Colleen Stephan on the mystery that still intrigues Newcastle. The disappearance of Catherine Winters, the 9-year-old who vanished, triggering a national sensation of news coverage and a community's confrontation with dark rumor and suspicion. More details at whereiscatherinewinters.com. It's one of those Indiana stories, and there are some great ones, that are still remembered. You know, think about that for a second. Indiana mysteries. Every state has its special tales. You might be able to think of one or two from around here. Drop me a note if you can. Well, that's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Marcus Jackman. Glad you could join us this time and hope you'll stay in touch, maybe with word of your own good Indiana stories. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have an idea. Reminder that we also need your ideas for places we should go and people we should talk to. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio, I'm John Strauss.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss of the Ball State Journalism Department. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Marcus Jackman. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from Dillman's Furniture, Muncie, serving East Central Indiana with home furnishings from Flex Steel, Bassett, and Simmons Beautyrest. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.